Okay, it's a pleasure to have Chris Pope, and he's going to tell us about gauge six-dimensional chiral supergravity and its origins from string theory.
I'm afraid my talk will not be as polished as the last one. This is my first attempt. I'm just thinking it might be quite a good idea to present the talk like this as it gradually fades off into the galaxies. Okay. So I'm going to be giving two talks here, and this first talk will be on gauge six-dimensional chiral supergravity and some of its properties and its origin, ultimately aiming to give a origin from string theory. And in my second talk tomorrow, which will be essentially disconnected, I'm going to talk about rotating black holes in higher dimensional space-time, de Sitter type or anti-de Sitter black holes, uncharged and charged. So those are really two disconnected topics, and today's will be on this six-dimensional chiral supergravity. So this is really a combination of pieces of work with Gary Gibbons and Miriam Svetich, Rami Guven and Marco Carilla, and also based on some earlier work with Miriam Svetich and Hong Liu on consistent dimensional reductions on spheres. So in six dimensions, it turns out to be a rather interesting dimension for looking at supergravities. And there is a well-known non-chiral theory in six dimensions known as 1,1 supergravity. That's one left-handed and one right-handed, so non-chiral supergravity. And that was constructed, the gauged theory was constructed by Larry Romans quite a few years ago. Now that theory arises from a higher dimension in a relatively conventional type of fashion. It comes from a kind of sphere reduction from 10 dimensions. And in fact, it turns out what you have to do, funnily enough, is to start with another of Larry Roman's theories, the 10-dimensional type 2A massive theory, and then a kind of warped four-sphere reduction from that gives rise to the Roman's gauged theory in six dimensions, his so-called F4 gauging of six-dimensional supergravity. Now, this theory has a feature that you cannot truncate it to a chiral theory. It's simply inconsistent with the supersymmetry transformation rules to perform such a chiral truncation. There's a completely different theory, and indeed really a class of theories in six dimensions that you could construct of gauged chiral supergravities, and these are the ones I want to talk about. They were constructed first by Nishino and Sezgin back in the 80s. And then Salam and Sezgin were interested in what you could use such theories for, and they made an interesting observation about the fact that you could get a natural four-dimensional Minkowski vacuum by reduction on a two-dimensional sphere. And so the Salam-Sezgin theory, I'll refer to quite a lot, is really the simplest of these chiral gauge six-dimensional supergravities. And it's an example where you take pure n equals 1,0 supergravity and couple it to one vector multiplet and one tensor multiplet in six dimensions, and then you can gauge it. So if you were to turn off the gauging, it would be a reducible theory there with supergravity plus that matter. But once you turn on the gauging, you cannot consistently set any of that to zero. So it kind of becomes irreducible after being gauged. Now, in what I'm going to present, I'm only going to talk about the bosonic sector. One can go through the entire process and see that everything is working nicely with the fermions as well, but for the purposes of illustration and to keep things relatively simple in the talk, I will concentrate just on the bosonic sector of the theory. So that's the Lagrangian up at the top, because it's got a single tensor multiplet, which is associated with an anti-Sov dual three-form field strength. And on the other hand, this supergravity multiplet has a self-dual three-form field strength. The two could be put together, and so you can actually write a Lagrangian in this special case when you have one tensor multiplet in these chiral six-dimensional theories. And so there is the Lagrangian for the bosonic sector up at the top. So you can see that we have gravity, of course, well, there's a root G around the whole thing. We have gravity and a scalar field, and then a three-form field, H sub 3, and a two-form, a U1 gauge field. And so it's that U1 gauge field is the one which is providing the gauging of the theory. So the fermions are all charged with respect to that U1 gauge field. And G here is the gauge coupling constant. Now, this theory has a potential for the scalar field. You can see that last term there. And it is a positive potential. And that is the opposite sign from the sign that typically occurs when you look at sphere reduction in order to obtain a lower dimensional gauge supergravity from the higher dimension. So, for example, if you take type 2B theory and reduce on the 5-sphere, that's believed to admit a consistent reduction down to 5-dimensional n equals 8 gauge supergravity. And if you look at the structure of the scalar potential there, of course, it's quite complicated because you have many scalar fields, but it is essentially a scalar potential that is negative at its extrema. And so it gives you anti-de Sitter type solutions in 5 dimensions. Well, here, of course, there's a dilaton involved there, so you won't find a stable anti-de Sitter solution in this 6-dimensional theory, but you can find solutions, which I'll talk about in a moment. But we are essentially seeing a potential term of the opposite sign. So it's going in the direction of de Sitter rather than anti-de Sitter. And that is rather unusual, and it means that there has to be a rather unusual origin for how this theory can come from the higher dimension. So it does not come from a four-sphere reduction from type 2A of the sort I mentioned for the Romans theory previously.
It's sort of a six-dimensional analog of the Friedman-Schwarz.
Very much so, yes, indeed. Indeed. Well, yeah, except Friedman-Schwarz, I think the sign is... it's very analogous in having a single term like that. Because it's also rather like the Romans theory in 10 dimensions as well. Well, this is the bosonic sector of the chiral theory. I mean, I'm not presenting the fermions, but this is... No, well, that's because there's we've got the supergravity multiplet, which has a self-dual three-form, and then we've got a single tensor multiplet, which has an anti-self-dual three-form. The two pieces are put together. And so in this case, with a single tensor multiplet, it's actually the bosonic part can be written using a Lagrangian. But the fermions are all chiral in this theory. Now, the observation that Salam and Sezgin made was that there exists a reduction, or well, a compactification of this six-dimensional theory to give a 4-dimensional Minkowski ground state. Now, that's, again, a rather unusual thing, because normally when you take a supergravity such as type 2B, and you can compactify it on S5, but you get an ADS5 cross S5 ground state. Here, it turns out that you get Minkowski times the 2-sphere if you do a compactification from 6 to 4 on the 2-sphere. And it's an interesting example because it really is kind of self-tuning and it lands you necessarily on Minkowski as opposed to anti-de Sitter or de Sitter. So what's going on is that it's essentially of a standard type of Freund-Rubin style of compactification. So the two-form in the theory I should have turned off. That will stop after a moment. All right. Yeah, I'll have to remember to touch this occasionally. it's a standard kind of Freund-Rubin style for the two-form field strength there, big like a magnetic monopole on the two-sphere. So omega 2 there is the volume form of the two-sphere. But because of the presence of the dilaton and because of the sign of its potential term, it turns out that the dilaton will be constant in this solution, but it tunes things so that you get a precise cancellation of the contribution from the Freund-Rubin term versus the contribution from the potential and from the curvature of the two-sphere. And so you end up with, literally, Minkowski, four dimensions times the two-sphere. Now, I'll come back a bit later in the talk to talk a bit more about this issue of the uniqueness of that solution there. But for now, let me just record that you do get this Minkowski four times two-sphere. So that was quite a considerable interest from the point of view of potential phenomenology, because at the time, particularly when Salam and Sezgin were looking at this, everybody was stuck with things like 11 dimensions reducing to ADS4 times S7, which was good fun, but it was hard to make the case that ADS4 was very realistic phenomenologically, whereas here there was a chance to get something more phenomenologically realistic. Now, as I'll also explain later on, that Minkowski times two-sphere vacuum is actually really can be viewed as a vacuum of a consistent two-sphere dimensional reduction from 6 down to 4 dimensions. And I'll elaborate a bit more as I go along about what I mean by consistent in that context. Well, first, let's look at the question of where does the Salam-Sezgin theory come from? So what is its higher dimensional origin? Well, as I said, a sphere reduction tends to give you a negative potential or negative cosmological constant. And so that's not going to be the way in which the Salam-Sezgin theory could arise. And in fact, it was quite a puzzle for a long time as where it could come from. But it turns out that what one has to do instead is to look at a theory in a higher dimension, supergravity, which itself comes from a non-compact gauging rather than a compact gauging of the sort you get from a sphere reduction. So without yet explaining, but I will in a moment, where the seven-dimensional theory in question comes from, let me first note that we can get the Salam-Sezgin theory by performing a circle reduction from seven dimensions of a particular gauge supergravity with an SO2,2 non-compact gauging. Now, of course, if you reduce anything on a circle, you're not going to get a chiral theory, so you have to do more. So it's a combination of reducing on a circle and then performing a chiral truncation. And as we'll see later, that procedure of making that truncation is very reminiscent of what goes on in the Harava-Witten construction of going from 11 dimensions down to 10. So the gauged theory in seven dimensions is, again, just focusing on the... is there a pointer? I didn't equip myself with any very satisfactory way. Well, never mind. There is the Lagrangian on the first line of equation there. Of the bosonic sector of the seven-dimensional SO2,2 non-compact gauged theory. And it's got a potential itself, V, written down below, which is constructed from the scalar fields, of which there are in total 10. There's a field you can think of as a dilaton. That's the capital phi field appearing there. And then there are 9 more scalars, which are described conveniently by a Wheelbein, pi a alpha, pi a capital A, excuse me, which is a 4x4 matrix, and that m alpha beta, as you can see, is sort of like constructing a metric from product of Wheelbeins, m alpha beta defined there in terms of product of 2 pi inverses. Now, in this all the expressions there, you can see in one or two places a eta AB appears, and you choose that to be Kronecker delta if you want the compact gauging SO4. You choose it to be 1, 1, -1, -1 if you want the non-compact gauging to get SO2,2, and that's what we shall be wanting in what I'm going to describe. Now, this theory here is described with a kind of redundancy by using a Wheelbein rather than using the basic scalars themselves. And that redundancy is associated with an additional kind of local symmetry group, we have two kinds of indices here. We have SO4C, C stands for composite, and that's SO4, regardless of whether you're doing the compact or the non-compact gauging. That's associated with the little A type indices, or the, I'm sorry, I think I mean alpha, not A, with the little alpha or beta type indices. So those are raised and lowered always using Kronecker delta, regardless of compact or non-compact. On the other hand, the capital A indices are the gauge indices, and those will be raised and lowered with eta AB, which would be Kronecker delta for SO4, but not in general. Okay, so that's the seven-dimensional theory. And you can see that you get a very different structure to its scalar potential depending upon whether you've chosen the compact or the non-compact gauging. So if we think about the vacuum, which is essentially to turn off all of those nine scalars, and turning off means setting the Wheelbine to be just Kronecker delta here, then if you're doing the compact gauging, then you get a negative potential. And if you're doing a non-compact gauging, SO22, on the other hand, then you get a positive potential. And a key point to observe here is that in this vacuum configuration, where pi is delta, you can see that M alpha beta will be a traceless matrix if eta is 1, 1, minus 1, minus 1. And so that whole second term, which would be giving the negative contribution to V, which would dominate in the compact case, is absent in the non-compact. Now, that difference in the scalar potential also reflects itself in many other differences, of course. And one of the key points is the issue of whether or not you can make a chiral truncation upon making a circle reduction from 7 down to 6. And there are many things, of course, that have to work when you check to see the consistency of such a truncation. But I'll just highlight one of the key points which illustrates the real difference between the two cases, the compact and the non-compact. If you look at the Gravitino transformation rule in seven dimensions, then I've written the key part of it up there, the derivative term, and then there's a term involving essentially the superpotential contribution, so, which turns out to be M alpha alpha, the trace of M. Remember, you contract indices there with Kronecker delta, times gamma mu epsilon, and then you get the terms, the standard kind of terms with the field strength contracted into gamma matrices, and I won't bother with those in what I want to highlight at the moment. Now, you can see that if you perform a dimensional reduction of that from 7 down to 6, you're not going to be able to make a chiral truncation if that second term is present, because you have a single gamma matrix, gamma mu, there, which is chirality reversing. And so you would be unable to truncate the Gravitino to be purely chiral and taking epsilon to be purely chiral of the same-handedness, because that second term there would spoil it all. It would force the other half of the chirality of psi mu to come back to life under supersymmetry transformation. So it would be not consistent with supersymmetry to make a chiral truncation if that term's there. But recall, as I just observed, that M alpha alpha is zero, in the vacuum at least, if you are in the non-compact SO22 case. And so that troublesome term disappears. Well, that's the first of several things that has to happen, and they do all happen, which means that you can perform a chiral truncation. And in fact, in the truncation that you need to perform to end up with the Salam-Sezgin theory, you precisely truncate out all nine of those scalar fields described by pi, and so indeed M alpha alpha is just zero, and the troublesome term, along with various other troublesome terms, all disappear. Well, amongst the other things you have to do in order to have that be a consistent chiral truncation is you have to set most of the SO2,2 gauge fields of the seven-dimensional theory to zero. And in fact, only one combination survives. It's a kind of diagonal combination out of the SO2,2. It's a diagonal U1. And so you end up with just a single gauge field in six dimensions. And that is the U1 gauge field of the Salam-Sezgin theory. So the whole thing works nicely, and if we start from that seven-dimensional SO2,2 gauged supergravity, we can reduce on S1, make a truncation, and end up with Salam-Sezgin. As I say, this truncation that one has to do here is reminiscent of the Harava Whitten story, and I'll come back to that later. Now, what about that seven-dimensional non-compact gauge theory? Where does that come from? Well, these things were studied quite a lot in the past, in the 80s. Chris Hull and Nick Warner and others looked quite a lot at the non-compact gauged versions of some of the higher dimensional supergravities. And it was evident that the way that you get those theories was associated with reducing on non-compact spaces rather than on compact spaces, on spheres. At that time, the issue of discussion of whether it was a consistent reduction or not was not addressed. Those things were really considered from the dimensional reduction point of view just at the linearized level. So I'll have more to say about the nonlinear structure as we go along. So in fact, what you can do is the following. You can obtain the SO22 gauge theory by making what is effectively an analytic continuation of the known S4 reduction from D equals 11 down to D equals 7. That S4 reduction would give you, of course, an SO5 gauge supergravity. That was worked out a few years ago explicitly by Van Nieuwenhuizen, Varman, and Nastasi. And if you take that theory, first of all, you can kind of stretch out the force sphere so that one direction gets elongated to an infinite line, and you're left effectively with this line times S3. And by taking that limiting case, you can then factor out by the line and view it instead as a reduction from 10 dimensions on S3 in that limit. But then furthermore, you can, either by analytic continuation or by starting from scratch with some changes in the original formula, some introduction of eta ABs in place of Kronecker deltas, you can formulate that reduction process from 10 down to 7 in such a way that you can get, if you wish, the non-compact gauged version.
Can I ask you one question?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, yeah. There are all kinds of potential problems like that. But yeah. What I'm really talking about here is more as more the mathematical question, if you like. Can you embed the lower dimensional theory as some kind of slice within? So in what I'm talking about here, we're thinking of truncating out all the massive stuff, regardless of, you know, worrying about how low the mass levels might be. That there's a rigorous statement here that if you perform the reduction, which is sort of sketched up here, that's how the metric would reduce from 10 down to 7. The three form is pretty complicated, so I've just put dot, dot, dot for that. And the dilaton has a simple expression. This is an exact statement, as a classical statement, that if you make this that ansatz up there and plug that in to the 10-dimensional n equals 1 supergravity, just pure n equals 1 supergravity in 10 dimensions, then as a rigorous statement, it is true that the fields on the right-hand side, which all depend only upon the 7 dimensions, those will satisfy precisely the equations of motion of the 7-dimensional gauge supergravity. And you can extend that to include the fermions as well. So that's what I'm talking about at this point. So I'm not actually concerned for this question with your point about the mass gap. But of course, it is something you want to worry about if you really want to kind of understand it physically. Okay, so how is this reduction being described? Well, what's going on is that we describe the three-sphere, or in our case, it's going to be a hyperboloid rather than a three-sphere by putting in some sign changes. We describe it in terms of a set of four coordinates called mu A, which satisfy a quadratic constraint, that one higher up, eta AB, mu A, mu B equals 1. So if eta were Kronecker delta, then that would be putting you on a three-dimensional sphere. In our case, we take eta AB to be 1, 1 minus 1 minus 1. So MAB, again, is describing those extra 9 scalar fields. And you can see on the top line there, the metric reduction ansatz, that the 10-dimensional metric is written in terms of the 7-dimensional metric, and then the add-on part at the end is the metric in the internal directions, and the scalar fields, oh dear, the scalar fields enter in a slightly involved way through a sort of distortion of the sphere, or the hyperboloid. Okay, so being explicit in our SO22 case, the four coordinates mu are subject to this condition. I can't quite reach just up there. But it should be emphasized that the metric that we're taking here is a metric of Euclidean signature. We start with Euclidean four space with the four coordinates mu, with the standard Euclidean metric here, and we impose the hyperboloid restriction up above. And so in the ground state, that metric has an isometry group, which is the intersection of SO4 that leaves the Euclidean metric invariant, and SO2,2 that leaves the constraint invariant. And so that intersection is SO2 cross SO2. Now, the scalar fields are playing an essential role in the way that this non-compact gauging works. And in fact, you can see that if you wanted to think about obtaining what I was just describing as an analytic continuation away from the usual three-sphere reduction, if you merely took two of the mu's and sent them to I times themselves, which is what you'd think you'd have to do to get the constraint to be that SO22 constraint, then you'd have the same unfortunate thing happening in the metric as well, and you'd end up with a situation with indefinite signature. If you do it by analytic continuation, you have to do appropriate analytic continuations on the scalar fields at the same time to compensate for those minus signs that you would otherwise be introducing in the metric. Remember that in the metric, you have this inverse scalar m to the minus 1 ab, and so with appropriate analytic continuations, you can compensate for the minus signs you'd otherwise introduce. That's one way of viewing it. It's probably not the easiest way, but you can view it through analytic continuation like that. The scalar fields play an essential role. And you can see that also from the point of view of the non-compact gauged supergravity in seven dimensions itself. If you didn't have scalar fields at your disposal, and you had SO2,2 Yang-Mills fields, then you would have necessarily a theory that had ghosts. You would have wrong sign kinetic terms for some of the Yang-Mills fields. And that's easy to see, because the only invariant kinetic term you could write down, built from the Yang-Mills fields, the only way you could contract the A, B, C, and D indices on F mu nu, would be with the Cartan-Killing metric, which was of indefinite signature. But in fact, what is happening in the gauge theory, there it is again, that the kinetic terms, that star F wedge F, that's another way of writing F mu, they're contracted with these scalar fields built from the Wielbein pi. And that precisely manages to ensure that you get positive sign kinetic terms for all of the gauge fields. And then those scalar fields themselves, again, you might be worried that you would get negative sign kinetic terms for some of those. You don't. The whole thing turns out to be ghost-free and proper sign kinetic terms. Now, one consequence of that is that it means that, in fact, if you look at any vacuum of the non-compact gauge theory, you will never find a vacuum in which you have unbroken non-compact gauge group gauge fields. It always gets spontaneously broken in any vacuum down to some compact subgroup of the non-compact gauge group. And that reflects itself also in the nature of the metric. I was emphasizing that the metric will be positive definite signature, and it will have a compact isometry group in the vacuum state. And another thing that reflects itself in the nature of the metric is that instead of having the three-sphere metric in the ground state, which of course is a homogeneous space, the ground state metric in the non-compact gauging is not a homogeneous space. It's called H2,2. I think this notation was introduced maybe by Chris Hull. The 2,2 signifying 2 plus and 2 minus signs in the constraint on the quadratic constraint on the mu's. So one way to see the metric a bit more clearly and to see how it's differing from the way it would work with a sphere is if you take the constraint up at the top, you can solve it by writing as on the second line there, mu1 plus I mu2 as cosh rho e to the I alpha and so on. And so that solves the constraint. And then plug in to the Euclidean metric the sum of the d mu I squared, and you get the equation for ds3 squared written below. And you can see that that thing is not a homogeneous space. It's got a u1 cross u1 of isometries acting as shifts on the angular azimuthal coordinates alpha and beta. But that's the extent of its isometry group. It's non-compact. It's non-homogeneous, the metric there. Well, you can put everything I've been describing so far together. I described in outline how you get from seven dimensions down to six with a truncation to get Salam-Sezgin, and I described in outline how you get from 10 down to seven to get that SO22 theory. Put it all together, and here is the full story for the reduction ansatz from 10 down to 6 to give the Salam-Sezgin theory. So the reduction coordinates are z on the circle from 7 down to 6, together with rho, alpha, and beta, the coordinates on the H2,2. And so now with that, it gives an exact embedding of Salam-Sezgin in 10 dimensions, and so any solution of the Salam-Sezgin theory can be lifted back to give an exact solution in 10-dimensional n equals 1 supergravity. And it's very useful sometimes to have these exact embeddings because it allows you to construct solutions in the lower dimension and lift them up, and you know that you've got a solution in the higher dimension. And as you probably know, that's proved to be very useful in quite a number of contexts, both in the case of circle reductions and also more recently in the case of sphere reductions. Now, I mentioned that there was the Minkowski times two-sphere vacuum, which had intrigued Salam-Sezgin years ago. It's of interest to see to what extent that vacuum was, if you like, unique. And so with Gary Gibbons and Rami Guven, we looked at this question, following some techniques that Gary had been using in other theories in the past. But essentially what you do is that you parameterize the most general possible compactification ansatz that you could make that would be compatible with symmetries that you want to assume. So what we did was to say, supposing we don't prejudice the matter by assuming that we have a Minkowski for vacuum, supposing we were prepared to settle for a four-dimensional vacuum of maximal symmetry, but not necessarily Minkowski. In other words, it could be Minkowski or ADS or de Sitter, depending upon the sign of a cosmological constant in four dimensions. So we assume that in four dimensions, R mu nu is lambda G mu nu, with the metric being Minkowski, ADS, or DS. Now, with the assumed maximal symmetry of that four-dimensional metric, it means that quite a lot of the fields of the Salam-Sezgin theory must necessarily vanish. So you can't have anything that would single out a vector or a two-form in four dimensions. That would break symmetry. So F mu nu and F mu M, where M lies in the extra dimensions, must vanish. And the three-form, H3, must vanish for the same reason. But you could allow the internal components of F, obviously, to be non-zero. So Fmn could be some function of the coordinates y on the internal space times epsilon mn. And then the metric could be of the general form of a warp factor times the four-dimensional maximal symmetry metric plus the internal two-dimensional metric. So ym are the coordinates of the two-dimensional metric, not yet presumed to be a two-sphere, just allowed to be arbitrary. Well, we'd ask, do there exist solutions with this structure? So it's presumed that that in the four dimensions it'll be either ADS or DS or... Oh, the radius. Well, it's free for now. No assumption is being made. Excuse me? What do you mean, because there's no scale in the... well, I mean, you could imagine an integration constant that came up, I guess, that would fix the scale. Well, it doesn't. Yeah, this case is different because you've got this dilaton and there's a kind of scale invariance to everything.
I understand. In this case, it's free to be empty.
Okay, so that, up at the top then is the most general possible form that the vacuum could take, consistent with the assumptions. And so now you could look at what you learned from the equations of motion. Now, from some combination of the dilaton and Einstein equations, you can get the equation indicated as equation one there. All the derivatives are with respect to the coordinates y of the internal two-dimensional space, which we're assuming to be compact. And so you can see with the first term being a total divergence that if you integrate that, only the last term survives, and thus you get that lambda times the integral of w squared vanishes, and thus, lambda vanishes. So straight away, we learn that it can't be ADS or DS. It must be singling out lambda equals zero. Now, if you've, that hasn't yet told us about the nature of the internal two-dimensional space. If we take that equation 1 again, now having learnt that lambda is 0, so the second term is absent, then if you multiply by phi minus 4 log w and integrate over the two-dimensional manifold and integrate by parts, and we can do that without picking up boundary terms because we're assuming the internal space is compact without boundary, then you learn by standard argument that phi must be 4 log w plus a constant. The constant is not relevant. It can be absorbed. And so you learn that the dilaton is equal to 4 times log of the warp factor. Now, if you look at the remaining content of the Einstein equations, from the trace-free part of the internal components of the Einstein equation, you get an equation which allows you to deduce that the gradient of w squared is a conformal Killing vector. And because we're in two dimensions, that means if you skew that with the epsilon tensor, then you get an ordinary Killing vector. So we learn that the internal space, capital Y, has a Killing vector. The Maxwell equation shows that the two-form field must be like that, and so Q, that constant of integration, has the interpretation of a magnetic charge. And now if you go back to the trace of the internal components of the Einstein equation, then that tells you about the Gauss curvature of the internal space. The Gauss curvature is the function, a priori function, kappa, which appears in the Ricci tensor equation Rmn is kappa times Gmn. Because we're in two dimensions, Rmn must be proportional to Gmn before you even use equations of motion. So that's the Gauss curvature, and you learn that by integrating the equation that you derive for the Gauss curvature, that the Euler number, which is 1 over 2 pi integral of kappa, is given by that expression there, which is a sum of positive terms. So we learned that the compact two-dimensional space has a positive Euler number, and thus there can only be one possibility. It must be topologically the two-sphere. Now, we already learned that there was a killing vector. This killing vector must have fixed points. And so, in fact, that killing vector must be describing an azimuthal translation on the two-dimensional space. And so now we can boil things down to ordinary differential equations, and we know that we can write the metric like that. So the warp factor now depends only upon some kind of latitudinal coordinate on the two-dimensional space, which is now known topologically to be a sphere, but not yet known metrically to be a sphere. Well, it's easy enough to solve the ordinary differential equations. And what I've written up there is not the most general solution you can find, but you can readily see that there's an integration constant which, unless it vanishes, you'll get highly singular solutions. So you can straight away rule out a non-vanishing value for that integration constant if you want to have any hope of non-singular solutions. And then you get down to a simpler class of solution, which is depicted up there. Now, it's easy to see that that metric, that two-dimensional metric, is just the ordinary two-sphere metric in disguise in the case that R0 and R1, these two constants of integration, well, they're constant of integration. No, they're not. One of them is related to the gauge coupling G. R0 is related to G. R1 is related to the constant of integration that was the magnetic charge. Unless R0 equals R1, it's easy to see that that metric will have singularities. If R0 equals R1, then after a coordinate transformation, you can see that it's just the two-sphere with its standard round metric in disguise. And thus, that completes the proof that the most general possible solution, which is regular and of the form of a four-dimensional maximally symmetric space-time, times a compact internal two-space, the most general possible such metric is the Salam-Sazgin-Minkowski times two-sphere vacuum. Now, if you do consider, nonetheless, the cases which are singular that correspond to changing the values of the gauge coupling G and the magnetic charge Q so that you don't have R1 equals R0, then it turns out that what you have is a two-dimensional space which is relatively mild in the nature of its singularities. It has a conical singularity. You could choose to have the conical singularity up at what would be like the North Pole or at the South Pole, or you can distribute it and have it at either. It all comes down to how you choose the period of psi, the azimuthal coordinate. But you can't simultaneously remove the conical singularity at the North and the South Poles. There's no single choice for periodicity for psi that achieves both. And so we necessarily have a space with a conical at least one conical singularity, possibly two. Now, if you work out the deficit angle, then it turns out that it's given by that formula, 2 pi times 1 minus the ratio of the squares of R1 over R0. R1 and R0, remember, were related to the magnetic charge and the gauge coupling. And there is a direct quantization condition relating the gauge coupling constant G and the magnetic charge Q, and that is given by this expression here. So 4G over Q must be an integer. And the case of the round sphere is achieved by taking that integer equal to 1. In general, plugging into from the previous transparency and plugging into the deficit angle formula, you find the deficit angle is given by this thing at the bottom. And thus, in general, it will be negative. The deficit angle will be negative if the integer is anything other than, 0 or 1. So n equals 1 gives us the two-sphere. Larger values of n give us negative deficit angle and therefore negative brain tension. So we can think of there being brains with the delta function sources sitting at wherever we have these deficit angles, but with the deficit angle being negative, it means that the tension of that brain will be negative. Okay, so if we want regular solutions, compactifications, if you like, to four dimensions, then it has to be that Minkowski 4 times S2. Now, what about the theory that you get if you perform a reduction on that two-sphere, a dimensional reduction? Now, in general, there's nothing ever to stop you performing a dimensional reduction on any space you like, provided that you keep all of the infinite towers of massive fields, as well as any massless fields there may be, that arise in the reduction process. It's really just a process of performing a harmonic expansion with respect to harmonics on the internal space. It's always a consistent thing to do that. What is not in general consistent is to truncate out the massive modes, the infinite towers of massive modes, and keep only the subset of massless fields at the bottom of the towers. Now, you can do that if you're reducing on a circle, as was first conceived by Kaluza and Klein. And you can always do it if you reduce on a group manifold, which has an isometry group G left times G right. And if you keep only the subset of fields which are invariant under one or other of those group actions. For example, if you keep everything that's a singlet under the right action of the group on a group manifold, then you will necessarily have a consistent reduction down to that subset of fields, and you'll be left with a finite set of fields, including the gauge bosons of the left action of the group on the group manifold. But that's not the way that dimensional reduction giving rise to non-abelian gauge fields was first conceived. Interestingly enough, the first person who proposed that you could perform a dimensional reduction on a higher dimensional internal space and get gauge fields from the isometry group of the internal space, the person who first proposed that was Pauli back in 1953. Klein did not propose getting the gauge fields from the isometries of the internal space. He did something rather intriguing, in which he had a circle reduction, a single circle, and then he had some components of the metric being non-commuting, and he built up his SU2 like that. He was looking for SU2, but he never proposed using a group manifold or a coset space or anything like that. It was Pauli who first proposed this, and this was long before group manifolds had been proposed, in fact. De Witt in 1963 suggested using group manifolds. So Pauli, in fact, had in mind, as his kind of his first example of this, he had in mind the idea of performing a reduction on a two-sphere. But if you look at his paper, it wasn't a paper actually, but some notes he wrote to a colleague. He was aware of the fact that that wasn't really going to work in a very straightforward way at all. You have this problem with this inconsistency of being unable to truncate out the massive modes. He didn't quite express it like that, but that's what he was hedging around in what he was talking about. Now, it's rather easy to see, in general, why you're going to run into trouble on this score. Let's take an example. Supposing you just thought about reducing a theory of pure Einstein gravity in a higher dimension, and you try reducing it on some space, a sphere or some coset space in general, whatever you like. Assume it's some space that has Killing vectors. Well, if you look at what the lower dimensional Einstein equation will be like, so you take Rmn minus a half Rgmn and restrict the indices to lie in the lower space-time dimensions, then if you calculate it out, you'll find that you get an equation of that form. I'm suppressing all the scalar fields that you would need, which would be a horrendous complication in this, but they would not get you out of this basic problem. You'll get an equation of the sort displayed there. On the left, you get the lower dimensional Einstein tensor. On the right, what you would like to see is the stress tensor of the Yang-Mills gauge fields that you're getting from this reduction. But unfortunately, the Yang-Mills indices, the capital I and J here, are not directly contracted with each other with the Cartan-Killing metric. Instead, they're contracted with the Killing vectors on the internal space. So you have this GMN, KMI, KNJ, instead of a Kronecker delta type of thing that's contracting. Now that gives you an equation that simply doesn't make sense, because the left-hand side depends only on the lower dimensional coordinates. That stress tensor, but with the indices not yet contracted, depends only on the lower coordinates, but it's multiplied by a prefactor, which depends upon the coordinates of the internal space. And so you're not able to read off a consistent lower dimensional Einstein equation from this. In fact, what's really happening is that this thing on the right-hand side, if you were to think of doing some kind of a mode expansion where you kept all the modes, this thing on the right-hand side is trying to act as a source not only for the graviton, for the massless metric field itself, it's also trying to act as a source for massive spin 2 fields. And you could do a kind of semi-linearized analysis, and on the left-hand side, you could have a sum over linearized Ricci tensors for the massive as well as massless modes, and you would see that the y-dependent parts, the parts depending upon the coordinates of the internal space, coming from the right-hand side, are trying to excite massive modes of spin 2. And so because you've set those massive modes to zero in the reduction ansatz, you've run into trouble. So that's what happens in general if you try to perform a reduction on a space like a coset space, for example, a sphere. It won't work. The problem can be invaded in special cases, and it always requires some kind of conspiracy between the theory that you're reducing and the space on which you're compactifying. And the essential way in which it works is that what is happening is that you have, in your full theory, you have not only an Einstein equation with zero on the right-hand side in the higher dimension, you have sources from the stress tensor of other higher dimensional fields. And if you have the appropriate nice conspiracies occurring, then you can have the situation that those other higher dimensional fields will also have the gauge bosons of the lower dimensional theory appearing in their ansatz. When you plug the whole thing in together, you get a miraculous set of conspiracies where you get additional terms like this, but with extra stuff. For example, typically, gradient of killing vector times gradient of killing vector has an add-on in the prefactor there. And miraculously, if you're compactifying on the right space, and more or less always that has to be a sphere if there's to be any chance at all, then miracles occur, and the whole thing assembles into the Cartan killing metric of the gauge group. And you can have a consistent theory with no mismatch of Y dependence between the left and the right-hand side. So classic examples where that works, or where we believe it works, is the seven-sphere reduction of 11-dimensional supergravity, the four-sphere reduction of D equals 11, that's the only one that's ever really been done fully explicitly, and then the five-sphere reduction of type 2b supergravity. Those will be three examples where conspiracies occur, or we believe that they occur. Well, in fact, this Salam-Sezgin theory, reduced on S2, provides another example, and it's really the simplest of all the examples, and it can be viewed as more or less the minimal theory you would need in which to realize Pauli's original idea of getting SU2 gauge fields from a two-sphere reduction. And it works precisely because of the reason I said that the ansatz for the where the lower dimensional fields appear in the ansatz is such that you get conspiracies. So I've written up the answer here, and so without dwelling on the details, the key point is that the gauge fields not only are appearing where you first of all expect them in the internal components of the higher dimensional metric, but the same gauge fields, the SU2 gauge fields, are appearing in the ansatz for the three form through their field strengths, the FIs, and they're appearing in the two form as well. And put it all together, stir it up, miracles occur, and you find that you consistently read off four-dimensional equations when you plug this ansatz into the six-dimensional equations of motion of the Salam-Sezgin theory. And you can check also with the fermions that works too. So that's how it manages to be consistent, but it looks just like a whole amazing set of miracles when you actually do the calculation. Well, what you end up with then is a four-dimensional theory, which is consistently arising from Salam-Sezgin, and which comprises an n equals 1 supergravity coupled to SU2 Yang-Mills, together with a scalar multiplet. And the way it arises initially is in the red box up at the top with a three-form fields still, the one we had in six dimensions. You can do a dualization and turn that into an axion if you wish and make the theory look a bit more conventional in four dimensions. If you were to look at the full theory with the towers of massive states as well, then what you would find is that the mass scale for all of those massive modes would be the gauge coupling constant G times e to the half phi naught, where phi naught is the vacuum value of the dilaton in this Minkowski vacuum. Just make one other remark about the four-dimensional theory. You can look for solutions there, and of course, knowing now how that embeds in 6 and then in 7 and then in 10, you could lift any solution in four dimensions all the way up to 10 if you wished. And one example of solutions in this theory are some things I looked at with Gary and Rami Guven and Marco Carilia. We looked at so-called non-abelian PP waves, which is a generalization to a curved background of some solutions that Coleman constructed years ago in flat space-time. So you can have a configuration as shown up there with the metric taking a standard kind of PP wave form, and you can have the non-abelian Yang-Mills, the SU2 Yang-Mills, also non-zero, and you find that with some arbitrary functions arising, and the best way to describe it is in terms of a complex notation as shown there, you find that you can get these so-called non-abelian plane wave solutions. So that's one example of solutions within that four-dimensional theory. Okay, well, finally, let me just talk about some work I'm engaged in. It's been dragging on a bit, but we're trying to make progress. This is with Eric Bergshoff, Ginseskin, and Kelly Stell. We've been trying to look at obtaining six-dimensional anomaly-free theories by this means. What I described with getting the Salam-Sezgin theory from 10 dimensions was very much a classical discussion of supergravity reduction. But the Salam-Sezgin theory itself is anomalous. It's a chiral theory in six dimensions. It's such theories are subject to possibility of gravitational and gauge and mixed anomalies. And unless you get just the right mix of matter fields to achieve an anomaly cancellation, then you're going to end up with an anomalous theory. Salam-Sezgin itself is an anomalous theory. So the discussion given is really a classical one up until now. But question arises, can one try to get consistently anomaly-free six-dimensional chiral theories along the same lines as what we've been describing here? And if so, how could that work? Well, now let me remind you that this chiral truncation in going from 7 to 6, that, of course, is the step where the anomalies are introduced in choosing to truncate in a chiral fashion from the seven-dimensional SO22 gauge theory down to six dimensions, where we chose to get the Salam-Sezgin anomalous theory. But that step is sounding very reminiscent of Harava-Witten, 11 down to 10, where you start with, if you viewed it just at the level of supergravity and took D equals 11 supergravity, reduced on S1, and then did a mod Z2 factoring, keep only the parity even states, then you get N equals 1 pure supergravity in 10 dimensions, and it's chiral and it's anomalous. Well, we know in that case with the Harava-Witten procedure that what you need to do instead is to think of that S1 mod Z2 as an interval, and you've got a brain on each end, and then you introduce gauge fields on the brain at each end, and cleverly you find by putting E8 cross E8 gauge fields, then you will get a kind of inflow to cancel the anomaly, and you end up with the heterotic E8 cross E8 theory on the brains at the endpoints of S1 mod Z2. Yeah, here you've got more freedom, but you need it actually because, but it's not easy to find anything that works. I mean, we haven't succeeded yet. In fact, it's you have got more freedom, But I think you need it it's not obvious how you can actually achieve at all. So this is really a hope at this point rather than a statement of what actually works. But in fact, when we do that Z2 factoring from 7 down to 6, really, if you just strictly insist on keeping everything that's parity even under Z2, then you will, first of all, you will keep rather more than is simply the field content of the Salam-Sezgin theory itself. You will have some extra fields, but you will still have an anomalous theory. You now need to think about what can be done by way of introducing Green-Schwarz anomaly-canceling terms and then introducing gauge fields on brains. We now think of that reduction from 7 down to 6 as being on S1 mod Z2, and we have 5 brains at the 2 endpoints. And we would ask structure of matter can we introduce on those 5 brains in order to try to achieve an anomaly cancellation. So that's still work in progress, but if that were to work, then it would provide a way of getting some of these anomaly-free Nishino-Sezgin type chiral theories in 6 dimensions via this kind of a route from 10 or 11 dimensions. And then we'd have a truly kind of string theory or M-theory origin for these theories. And as I say, these theories then themselves have quite a lot of interesting properties of the sort I was talking about. Well, I think I should stop at that point. So, thank you.
Questions?
In the uniqueness proof of M4 by S2, does the ansatz for, in particular for dilaton, follows necessarily from Bogomolny equations, or it is an ansatz?
For the dilaton, yeah. We just assume that it depends on the coordinates of the internal space.
Yes, just that.
And that's all that you can have consistent with the assumption of maximal symmetry for the four-dimensional space-time.
Yes, but it doesn't follow from supersymmetry.
No, supersymmetry is not assumed.
Okay.
It's a deduced. In fact, I should say that the upshot of the calculation, because the Minkowski times S2 solution is supersymmetric, the upshot is that the only maximally symmetric.
So the claim is not that it is the most general supersymmetric vacuum.
The claim is it's the most general regular solution with maximal symmetry, not right. Supersymmetry, symmetry, okay. For the four-dimensional space-time. And it happens to turn out to be supersymmetric.
Any other question? So let's go for lunch and we come back at 3 o'clock.